The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with the Reader's Digest. Well, since we are still in summer, and this looks like the kind of thing that would be valid for that, it's the health section. Stop the ride. Amusement parks are meant to thrill, but often they just make us sick. One intrepid rider is on a quest to find out why she's always losing her lunch. And for those of us who have had that experience, that is not a fun thing to have happen. It's March in Florida, and I'm walking around Hogsmeade Village in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter at Universal Orlando. It's a Christmas card come to life. A picturesque setting with charming storefronts, cobbled streets, and faux snow-capped buildings with crooked chimneys. My friends and I want to see Hogwarts, so we head to the Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey ride, a flying adventure through the castle. We pass through the gates, and eventually it becomes dark and atmospheric, with cold stone walls and stained glass windows everywhere. Talking portraits speak to us as we drove deeper into the castle. Professor Dumbledore welcomes us to Hogwarts. "You may encounter all manner of things not common to your own world," he warns. As we approach the end of the line, Harry, Ron, and Hermione appear and invite us to watch a Quidditch game. A roller coaster-style car pulls up next to us. It looks like some kind of an enchanted bench. Above us, countless candles float in the air as if they're all under a spell. I say to my friend, "I think this is a ride that made me feel sick last time." We walk onto the moving platform and take our seats. I pull the ride restraint over my shoulders and it clicks into place. The bench abruptly moves sideways and we're lifted into the air, feet dangling. We're swept up and to the side at the same time, which throws me off balance. Instant regret. My heart is beating hard. I'm accumulating spit in my mouth, and after a few seconds, I'm already dizzy and nauseous. I'm hyper-aware of my body as it shifts and sways at the mercy of the robotic arm that lurches me, tilts me, turns me. I hold on for dear life. I've been told that the ride is about 4 minutes long, but it feels as if I'd entered a portal to another dimension where time loops on and on and on. I suddenly remember the $8 Butterbeer I chugged right before the ride. Not smart. Whoops. I close my eyes. I know I'm going to be sick. I can't escape it, but maybe I can delay it. I take a deep breath, shaky breaths. I brace myself against the unpredictable movements, and then I let it happen. I surrender to the ride's pre-programmed destiny. Its force is bigger and stronger than mine and better engineered. I'm flung around like a rag doll. I curse Harry Potter and his friends, the ride designers, the thrill seekers who rave about the ride, and most of all, me, for willingly going on it. I open my eyes and see Harry on screen flying a broom through a Quidditch field, and then I throw up all over my lap, in my hands, and into the open air. I love amusement parks. I love rides. Unfortunately, they make me barf. There was a time I emerged green and shaky-legged from the Simpsons ride, a motion simulator attraction at Universal Studios Hollywood, and another occasion when I nearly blacked out from the G-Force on Dueling Dragons, a roller coaster in Universal Orlando, retired in 2017. It's not just rides. I once spent six stomach-churning hours in a cabin of a rocking lobster fishing boat, and I often feel disoriented on an especially windy car ride. But I've always denied my propensity for motion sickness. That is, until I found myself wandering around Universal's Orlando Islands Adventure, carrying a plastic bag stuffed with my puke-covered clothing and searching for a new pair of shorts. It was then, at age 27, having thrown up at multiple amusement parks in my life, that I realized motion sickness was something I'd have to live with, and that even though I've loved going on theme park rides since I was a kid, I've never been able to fully experience what they built to do, give me a freewheeling, exhilarating thrill. Thrill seekers want an extreme adrenaline rush, but they also an emotional journey. Theme parks are designed to deliver both. The fear and ultimate satisfaction we feel from thrill rides is similar to what we seek in a horror movie or a painfully spicy hot sauce. They're all benign forms of masochism. There's an enduring interest in theme parks and their manufactured thrills. In 2019, over half a billion people visited theme park worldwide. The global theme park industry, valued at just over $55 billion, is built on family fun, shared experiences, and escape. It's about getting away from the everyday and disappearing into a different world, says Sabrina Mittermeier, author of A Cultural History of the Disneyland Theme Parks. There's no time to think about your silly little problems when your body is flying through the air against all odds. But what happens when a ride that's meant to excite you or make you feel awe doesn't strike that perfect balance of fun and fear? What does a shattered mirage look like? Up to a third of the people experience motion sickness. It's the body's response to different types of movements that cause disequilibrium, a sensation of unsteadiness, imbalance, and spatial disorientation. Cue the nausea, dizziness, headaches, cold sweats, general unwellness, and, well, barfing. Anyone can get motion sickness. It's been described as a natural response to unnatural conditions, and somehow that makes me feel a little better. Children as young as 2 can experience, and women are more susceptible than men, as are migraine sufferers and those with inner ear troubles. Heck, sheer anticipation may bring it on. People who have experienced it in the past may have worse symptoms brought on by expecting to feel sick. Motion sickness can be felt anywhere, land, sea, air, and space. Charles Darwin was continually seasick on his nearly 5-year journey on the HMS Beagle, writing in 1835, "I hate every wave of the ocean with a fervor which you, who have only seen the green waters of the shore, can never understand." Angsty? In recent decades, new technology that mimics vehicle travel, such as flight simulators, virtual reality VR headsets, video games, and motion simulator rides, have joined the classic motion sickness provokers. The car, the rail car, the airplane, and the boat. You just can't escape it. The cause of this condition is simple. Motion. The reason why motion does this to us is not so simple. Sensory conflict theory says sickness is brought on by a mismatch between what the eye sees and the information the brain receives from the vestibular organ located in the inner ear, which is responsible for balance. So when the eyes tell the brain that a person is sitting still on a boat, for example, but the vestibular system senses head movements from waves rocking against the ship, these mismatched messages are traditionally believed to cause disorientation, which can lead to motion sickness. Thomas Sofergen has a different take. A professor of kinesiology at the University of Minnesota, he maintains that the inner ear is not the culprit. Instead, he says, blame the brain. In an inconsistent environment, such as a rocking boat, the brain can't influence the body's movement as it usually can. The result is that you lose your equilibrium first, and then you get motion sickness. To understand, just picture more me strapped to a seat and pushed through space. You're trying to stabilize the head against these motions, but you cannot predict and cannot control, Stoffergen says. That's why you got sick in that device. While I got sick on a very modern Harry Potter ride thanks to the mismatched stimuli between screens and physical motion, ride-induced motion sickness is nothing new. In 1893, ride designer Amira Lake invented an illusion apparatus called the Haunted Swing. Victorian-era riders entered a room and took a seat on the swing. Attendants gave him a push, and as one New Zealand newspaper described, the swing seems to whirl completely over, while the occupants shriek convulsively and hug each other. The ride mechanics deceived riders enough for them to believe they were the ones moving violently. In reality, they were stationary. It was the room that rotated. People were amazed by the engineering and overwhelmed by the physical experience, sometimes enough to vomit. But the ultimate trick in designing theme park rides is to perfectly calibrate their ups and downs so people don't end up sick. If you ask me, Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey missed their mark. On that day in March, the ride that did me in features a roller coaster style 4-seat bench mounted on a rheumatic arm that drops, spins, twists, and turns. The bench doesn't go upside down, but at one point riders are laid flat on their backs. And honestly, what's the difference? For me, there's too much movement. The arm is attached to a track, which moves through a physical set with animated props. Dome-shaped projection screens fill the rider's entire field of view. Read, There's nowhere else to look. As a press release from Universal Orlando gloated, the ride, which debuted in 2010, blended the first-ever combination of live-action advanced robotic technology and innovative filmmaking, creating a new, immersive experience. And hey, people really love it. There's a cult-like following online, with fans calling it a revolutionary ride with insane state-of-the-art tech that refreshes the indoor dark ride genre. But push the drama too intensely, and a person may never come back again. Ride designers must walk that fine line between safety and danger, while balancing the physical stress on the body. The truth is that thrill rides are designed into some level of discomfort. But what's too much? Throwing up? Whiplash? Blacking out from the G-force? Past and presence. Some rides go too far. One of the world's first looping roller coasters, the Flip Flap Railway at Coney Island Sea Lion Park, was infamous for knocking people out. It had a perfectly circular loop, which meant that passengers were dealt with serious G-force. In 1910, Rough Riders and other early Coney Island roller coasters tossed 16 passengers out of the car, killing four. Even if you don't die, some rides are notorious for making you sick, and even today. In 2022, the New York Post reported that Epcot employees were handing out barf bags at the new Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind ride, which rotates 360 degrees and has Disney's first-ever reverse launch on a roller coaster. On message board, park visitors plot when to take their Dramamine and ask which stomach-turning rides to skip. You can try to beat motion sickness, but once it sets in, it's already too late. The best way to stop motion sickness is to avoid situations that may provoke it. But if you're like me and absolutely must ride, look at the horizon. Try Dramamine. Consider acupressure. Press the center of the forearm 3 fingers width away from the wrist. Stay hydrated. Don't eat foods that are spicy, greasy, or fatty, i.e., the typical food you find at a fair. Try not to get annoyed when your friend says, "I didn't think it was that bad." The seat on the Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey ride was curved, so perk peeled under my butt and legs. Who's going to clean this, I thought, when the ride came to an end. Spaced out and doused in vomit, I stood up and watched as the bench rolled away. I hurried toward the nearest unmoving wall, squatted, and took deep breaths as my friends surveyed what had happened. The cool floor looked like a good place to lie for a while. Then I heard a voice, "Ma'am, I have a room for you." I glanced up and saw a kind employee looking down at me. From his expression, I could tell he had seen this before and knew exactly what to do. He ushered me to a door marked for employees only and opened it to reveal a hidden space, one dedicated to unfortunate souls like me who couldn't make it through the ride without getting sick. There was a square basin that looked like a toilet filled with water. It was a special puke sink with a silver flush handle. I hovered it over for a second, but I was all puked out. Two of my friends came in after me, and one of them was inspired to throw up, too. That's kind of interesting. The small room had a normal sink and soap and throw-up bags and paper towels. I wiped off my shorts and legs and removed my T-shirt, which was ruined. The attendant knocked on the door and asked if I needed anything. A new shirt, shorts, water. He came back with a blue T-shirt, size adult large, with a screen print of the Hogwarts castle. "Visit Enchanting Hogsmeade," it read. A $27 souvenir, free for the price of vomit. "No shorts," he said. As I scrubbed my body and donned my T-shirt, I asked the attendant, "Does this happen a lot?" "Pretty often," he said. I balled up my old T-shirt and my ruined hat and shoved them into a plastic bag. I was still shaky, but I took sips of water and felt ready to leave. I wobbled through the busy gift shop toward the bright Florida sunlight, dazed as people dressed in Hogwarts-themed clothing moved around me. I put my clammy hand to my cheek and took a Snapchat selfie with my barf bag. "Bags of shame," I posted. As I cowered in a shady area while my sister hustled around looking for a new pair of shorts for me, I thought about how quickly the illusion can shatter in theme parks. When you puke in a land of magic and whimsy, the wonder suddenly vanishes. Band of Survivors. Inspiration. Armed with his drum kit, a Holocaust survivor fights anti-Semitism one musical note at a time. Kind of appropriate in this time, day and age. Saul Dreyer stands in the wings of the Kennedy Center's Millennium Stage in Washington, D.C., waiting to be introduced. A short, wide, nonagenarian, he's appearing there with his Holocaust survivor band in December 2015, a few days shy of the new year. It's a prestigious venue for a musical group that up to that point had only existed for just over a year. Dreyer is excited but not nervous. He has seen too much in his lifetime to be unnerved by a mere performance. When the band is announced, the crowd greets it enthusiastically. Dreyer, 90, and Ruin Ruby Soskinolowitz, 88, both Holocaust survivors, take the stage dressed in matching red shirts, black vest, and black trousers. Soskinolowitz, the more reserved of the two, goes to his keyboard, barely acknowledging the crowd, while Dreyer waves and blows a kiss before taking a seat behind his drum kit. They are joined by younger musicians, including Soskinolowitz's daughter, Chana Rose, who sings and plays tambourine, a violinist, a guitar player, a horn player, a backup singer, and another keyboard player. Some of the children of survivors as well round out the band. A steady beat, followed by the shimmy of snare drums, introduces the first tome, Shalom Aleichem, meaning peace be with you. Shalom Aleichem, an old Yiddish tune. It tells of angels that visit on Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath. While some sing the song as a lullaby, Dreyer and Company play it fast and bouncy. Clara Kletzper Band, combining traditional Jewish folk songs with the boorish dance music of Eastern Europe. With a heavy dose of improv thrown in, like Yiddish jazz, think Yiddish jazz, the audience nods along. Many mouth the words or hum the tune. Chances are many of them know the song. In stark contrast to the upbeat tune, haunting black and white images from the Holocaust flash on the large screen behind the band. Prisoners being marched into the camps, bodies heaped on top of one another, fanners way to their inevitable fate. The band segues into Hava Nagila, the wedding standard. Dreyer leaps up to his feet and demands of the audience, "Everyone, clap your hands!" They do. Caught up, Dreyer remains vertical as he beats the drums. The photos are replaced by an illustration of dancing silhouettes under the words, "Enjoy yourself." When the song ends, Rose asks, "Are there any survivors or children of survivors in the Holocaust in the audience?" A man, a child of a survivor, stands and is warmly received. It's Osnanowicz's turn to sing now, and he slows things down with the heartbreaking Yiddish ballad, "Where Can I Go?" The lyrics describe the plight of the wandering Jew. "Tell me, where can I go? There's no place I can see. Where to go? Where to go? Every door is closed for me." The rest of the song list includes old Yiddish tunes that Dreyer and Soskinolowitz drew up with, such as Bimir Bitsushin, as well as American standards including Those Were the Days, My Friend, and a rousing rendition of To Life, Kalhayim, from Fiddler on the Roof. The audience is loving every second of it. The band is loving every second of it. But no one in the hall is loving it more than Saul Dreyer. Despite that nasty hand, life dealt him, Dreyer is naturally ebullient, blessed with an infectious smile, and a zest for life on display with each nimble crack of his drums, and the way his playful eyes engage the adoring audience. The crowd has some to see the band he's put together that honors fellow victims of the Holocaust. In an age of fading memories and Holocaust denialism, he sees it as his duty to make sure that no one forgets. His goal, he says, is to beat anti-Semitism. Poland, in 1925, the year Saul Dreyer was born, was a very different place than what it would become. Growing up in Krakow, surrounded by friends, a loving family, and the constant hum of music, life was idyllic, he says. All that ended in the fall of 1939, when invading German troops marched into his hometown. They imprisoned his father, who was a musician and an officer in the Polish army. His mother and others were herded into boxcars and sent via train to the concentration camps. He and his sister Helena moved in with their disabled grandmother. Under Nazi occupation, school was no longer an option for Jews. Instead, Dreyer was put to work sorting through furniture, clothes, and jewelry that the Nazis had taken from Jewish families. In 1941, Dreyer's world was again upended after he watched soldiers drag his grandmother into the town square and shoot her dead. Weeks later, shoulders separated the siblings and March Dreyer, and then 16, and other workers outside of the town, Plaszow labor camp, where he's given a new identity. 86540 was the Nazis tattooed on his forearm. The camp commandant was Amon Goeth. If that name sounds familiar, it's probably because he was depicted in the film Schindler's List. Following the war, Goeth would be executed for crimes against humanity. Such crimes include drunkenly riding his white steed through the camp while shooting prisoners for sport. Other times, says Dreyer, he fired at them from his balcony. In the camp, Dreyer was starved, humiliated, and whipped. Death was a constant presence. What sustained him was music. In those precious moments when he wasn't working 12-hour shifts at whatever job was forced on him, he could be found crammed into a single-room barrack with some 50 other men, often tucked into bunks stacked three high. To keep up their spirits, a cantor would lead the men in singing traditional Jewish songs. One time, Dreyer noticed they were out of sync. He found two metal spoons and kept the beat by clapping them together. That became his de facto job, the keeper of the beat, and he relished it. Singing helped me survive, he says. If you don't eat, but you work hard and you sing, you forget you haven't got food. Over the next few years, Dreyer, young and able-bodied, was moved from camp to camp, whenever workers were needed. One stop it was Oskar Schindler's factory repairing radiators for German fighters. Later, he spent time at Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria, where more than 95,000 Jews were killed. And an Austrian camp in Linz, an Allied bombing raid left Dreyer's hands, back, and skull riddled with shrapnel. Wounded and unable to work, he grew alarmed. He heard that the Nazis were gassing and burning Jews in the concentration camps, and now he says he feared the worst, telling another wounded friend, "We are going to die here like everybody else." Days later, in early May 1945, with the Germans aware that the war was nearing its end, the prisoners were marched at gunpoint a few miles to a cave in order to walk in. Some complied, others resisted and tried to flee. The soldiers opened fire. In the confusion, Dreyer, who was near the back of the line, saw a chance to escape and took it. He ran. Soon he heard an explosion. Dynamite had blown up the cave filled with prisoners. He kept running until he stumbled upon more soldiers. But these were Americans. After a brief recuperation, Dreyer was sent to Santa Maria de Bagli Displaced Persons Camp in Italy, where refugees were sheltered until they could return home or someplace else to leave. Once again, music sustained him. One fortuitous day, a truck arrived and unloaded a piano and a drum kit. While others gravitated towards the piano, Dreyer took the drums. Adept at playing the spoons, he figured, how hard it'd be? How hard could it be? It was the first time he had played on a proper drum kit. On weekend nights in the town hall, he would accompany the piano as local former prisoners alike danced. That, he says, is how I learned to play the drums. Santa Maria de Bagli gave him hope. It was also the site of his greatest despair. He learned from other former prisoners that both his parents had died in the camps, and as his sister and 24 extended family members. Dreyer would not be returning home. He was one of those who needed to find someplace else to live. In 1949, and there's a picture of Saul, not a bad looking young man. In 1949, Saul Dreyer, who had lost everything, began anew. He migrated to Brooklyn, New York, and got a factory job working as a welder. He met and married a fellow Holocaust survivor from Poland, Clara Brill, and the couple raised four children before moving to Florida in 1980. By then, Dreyer had stopped playing the drums. He was kept busy at work and had started his own construction company, and his family, which would eventually include eight grandchildren and three great-grandchildren. Then in 2014, he came across an article about a remarkable woman named Alan Hertz Somer, a Holocaust survivor who had died that year at age 110. If, as this has been said, a survivor's best revenge against Hitler is to lead a long and fruitful life, she certainly exacted hers. Her story resonated with Dreyer. While in prison in the camps, Hertz Somer, a concert pianist before the war, had drawn strength from playing music. Dreyer thought back on those spoons and his first drum kit. The article moved him to want to honor Hertz Somer and all the Jewish victims of the Nazis. And he knew how. It'd be through his shared love of music. Music to me is life, Dreyer says. If I play music, I'm alive. Performing traditional Jewish songs before an audience, he reasoned, would be a way to keep the victims, not to mention Judaism itself, alive. To do so, he would need to form a band. But not just any band, a bond of fellow survivors. First, a reality check. Saul Dreyer was 89 years old at the time, retired for 15 years, a stomach cancer survivor. Madness, right? That's what his wife told him after he sprung his plan on her. And that's what his rabbi said, too. But a man who has survived Amun Goth isn't easily dissuaded. My instinct told me that just on the contrary, because they told me I'm crazy, I'm going to do it, he says. Within days, he returned home from the music store with a 5-piece drum set and a resolve to form the Holocaust Survivor Band. His first recruit was an accomplished keyboard player and accordion teacher, Ruby Sosnowitz, who he met through a friend. Sosnowitz's family had fled Poland soon after the Nazis invaded. In the mad dash to escape, he became separated from his parents and siblings at the Russian border. A sympathetic farmer took him in until the war's end, when he made his way to Israel, then America. Unlike Dreyer's family, his family survived. The pair was soon by 4 younger musicians and an Israeli singer. To spare Clara the sound of his rusty drumming skills, Dreyer rented a room in a temple where the musicians could practice. There, the Klezmer band rehearsed Jewish folk songs like Israeli classic B'Shachna Haba, an upbeat tune with a deceptively sad backstory. The song is a memorial to the lyricist's brother who was killed in battle in 1968. "You will yet see, you will yet see, how good it will be next year," goes the song. Of course, there is no next year for the brother. The next step was finding a venue to play. Dreyer reached out to a nearby synagogue and offered to play free concert, reason if they charged, no one would show. "But if I'm going to play for free," he says, "everybody show up." And 400 people did. By their reaction, it was clear that it was Dreyer onto something. Even Clara was impressed, conceding, "Now I know you are a celebrity." The band, offering featuring different musicians, would go on to perform across the United States and around the world. Israel, Germany, Brazil, and Poland, in public libraries, colleges, community centers, malls. They played on a float parade down New York's Fifth Avenue during Israel Day parade. Dreyer even met President Joe Biden last year when he accompanied the Marine Corps band at the White House during a Hanukkah celebration. Wherever they play, they are met with enthusiasm and warmth, not because they're a novelty act, but because they have a message to impart. People are so interested because Saul brings the history of his Holocaust experience, says Mel Albin, who plays piano in the band. They want to know. They want to hear from a man who was marched into hell and survived. "Death called me several times in my life," Dreyer says on his website, "but I said no. I said to death that as long as I'm alive, I will live my life fully. I will inspire other people to share peace and wisdom around the world." To that end, Dreyer started a nonprofit, Saul Generation Foundation. That's SaulDreyer.com/foundation. That connects older and younger generations by, among other things, promoting education about the Holocaust. That's why Dreyer travels to schools and universities to share his experience. He says his hopes, his story of resilience serves as an inspiration for the world's youth, especially those who have suffered traumatic events. Dreyer's wife, Clara, passed away in 2016, and Sosnowitz has retired from the band. Still, Saul Dreyer plays on. He recently performed in front of high school students in Florida. Now at age 99, he figures the various iterations of the Holocaust Survivor Band have played nearly 100 shows. Each gig was meaningful. But if he had to pick one that stood out, it would likely be a performance in 2016, when he and Sosnowitz returned to their native Poland for the first time since the war. They headlined a concert in Warsaw, held outside in the former ghetto, where Nazis had confined over 400,000 Jews and sent nearly 300,000 to Treblinka extermination camp. Around 3,700 people, young and old, Jew and Gentile, gathered in the street. The air was electric. Everyone wanted to meet Dreyer and Sosnowitz. In a documentary, Saul and Ruby's Holocaust Survivor Band, we see a Christian couple engage Dreyer. The women's family members had hidden Jews from the Nazis. Nazis had great peril to themselves. She and Dreyer talk about peace and the horror of war. Then they wrap each other in a heartfelt hug. On stage, the MC addresses the audience. How many times will we have the chance to hear a Holocaust survivor's band? To remember what they went through, to remember those that we lost, and to remember those incredible few who stayed with us. So when you hear the Holocaust survivor band play, we'll all have to take upon ourselves to be their witness and to take on their message of peace and love to the entire world. He then introduces the band and Drawer and Sosnowitz mount the stairs to the stage, dressed in matching mint green shirts, black vest, and black trousers. Drawer takes his seat behind his drum kit, while Sosnowitz straps on his accordion, and the show is on. The elderly are clapping, teenagers dancing, everyone swaying. It's daylight when they start, and nightfall when they take their final bow. In the documentary, Drawer can be heard yelling over ecstatic applause in a loud, unwavering voice, "Never forget! Never forget! Never forget! Never again! Never again!" Each phrase punctuated by an emphatic thrust of his drumsticks. Wow. Just wow. That was a little heavier than I thought it was going to be. So let's switch to something Consumer Reports. While it's still dangerous, it's a little lighter. The danger in your dust. Was floating in your home's air could be harmful to your health. Here's how to keep your place clean and safe. When a sunbeam hits just right, you see them. Tiny particles of dust suspended in the air. They look innocuous until you stop to think about their tendency to collect on surfaces throughout your house. If you take a close look at those specks, you may spot skin, hair, and dander, says Gabriel Filippi, Ph.D., Executive Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute at Bloomington. Look closer still with an electron microscope or chemical analysis, and more unsettling things reveal themselves. Lead paint and other heavy metal fragments, microbes, fungi, molds, mites, microplastics, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFASs, and even toxins in some pesticides, says Philippi, who runs a project analyzing dust captured by people's vacuums. Because these substances are in the dust all around us, they end up in us, too. The chemicals in the dust in our hands can get into our food and be absorbed into our bodies through our skin. Kids ingest dust as they move around close to the ground. And we all inhale it, says Liberty Matsui, Ph.D., who researches indoor air pollution at the University of Texas at Austin's Dell Medical School. All this exposure has consequences. In the short term, dust can cause lung irritation, allergies, and asthma. Longer term, some chemicals in it are linked to diabetes, various cancers, reproductive problems, and other serious health problems. While humans have been exposed to dust for as long as we've existed, many of the harmful chemicals found in today's household dust are byproducts of our very modern world. That explains why an age-old problem, cleaning dusty surfaces, is worth taking on with a new urgency. Thankfully, unlike some environmental health problems that seem beyond our control, you can actually clean up the dust in your home. You just need the right tools. What's in your dust? You probably notice that no matter how many times you clean a shelf or a floor, dust turns up yet again, even in areas that have been barely used. It begs the question, where does it all come from? About half of your household dust comes from inside your own home. Filippi says primarily from cooking, pets, people, and consumer products. The rest is tracked, carried, or blown into our homes from outside. Chemical analysis finds that dust can contain a variable catalog of toxic byproducts from nature and industry, says Tasha Stoiber, Ph.D., a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group. That includes PFASs from carpets and other products coated with chemicals to make them stain and water resistant, as well as flame retardants like PBDE from electronics and furniture. Other chemicals of concern are phthalates and bisphenol A, BPA, from the plastic throughout our homes, volatile organic compounds that off-gas from furniture or paints, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are byproducts of burning formed by cooking, smoking, or wildfires. How tiny specks can harm you? It's hard to document exactly how exposure to the range of chemicals in dust affects health, says Andrea Gore, Ph.D., a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Texas at Austin. But she says over time, exposure to some of the hazardous compounds in dust has been linked to complex age-related problems such as diabetes and Parkinson's disease. Lead and other heavy metals can have a particularly pernicious effect on children, causing neurological damage and contributed to learning and behavioral disorders. Certain PFAs have been connected to some cancers, diminished immune function, thyroid problems, and liver diseases. Phthalates are linked to reproductive problems. Microplastics and nanoplastics that are consumed or inhaled are associated with cardiovascular problems, inflammatory bowel disease, and other potential health risks. Flame retardants may affect development in children and have been linked to reproductive issues and increased cancer risk. Ingested dust particles can lead to chemicals being absorbed through the gut, where they can get absorbed into our body tissue, Matsui says. The tinnitus particles, which are associated with cardiovascular disease, can go deep into the lungs and cross into the bloodstream. Any inhaled particles that also trigger breathing problems, like asthma in people of any age, indeed air pollution, including not only the contaminants we are exposed to while outdoors, but also those that are in our homes, is linked to millions of deaths worldwide each year. Where you live matters too. People exposed to more dust and more pollution, both indoors and out, face a higher risk of health problems, Matsui says. So dust and indoor pollution are a particular concern for people who live where wildfires are common, as well as those exposed to industrial pollution. In the U.S., those effects are often felt most acutely in low-income and marginalized communities, both because of their proximity to sources of outdoor air pollution and because their housing is likely to have worse air circulation due to lack of essential air conditioning and other factors, according to a National Academies of Science report that Matsui co-produced. Though the quality of the air where you live may be out of your control, you can reduce the risk posed by dust in your home with some planning and smart choices. For example, the EWG's Stoiber and colleagues found that after a California law went into effect limiting the use of flame-retardant chemicals in furniture, households that switched to furniture that was compliant with the new law saw flame-retardant levels in their dust go down. After 6 months, concentration of some types of flame retardants fell by roughly 50%. Other steps that can help reduce dust in your home, including becoming a shoes-off household, strategically using dehumidifiers and air purifiers, and choosing the right vacuum cleaner and other tools to rein in dust. The combined effect of many small steps can yield substantial health benefits, according to a report from the National Academy of Science. How big is your problem? One way to get a sense of what's floating in your home's air is by using an air quality monitor. These usually detect pollutants such as carbon dioxide and volatile organic compounds, but some can also measure particulates, aka dust. To find a monitor that detects dust, look for a label PM2.5 or PM10. That means it can identify particles that are 2.5 or 10 micrometers in diameter, respectively. Two such monitors that do well in CR's test are shown below, which I'll go into a second. For best results, place the monitor where you're most concerned about air quality, and consider buying multiple monitors to put in rooms that you use heavily, such as your bedroom, kitchen, and home office. Yes, if you can go out and spend this much money. TemTop Air Quality Monitor M100 US is $230. The Inkbird 6-in-1 Indoor Quality Monitor is only $90. So yeah, they ain't cheap. How dust gets in. Sealing off points where dust entered your house and minimizing spaces where it settles can make cleanup much easier. Keep dirty shoes and paws out. Get a doormat and scrape off debris from shoes. Put shoes in a closet or on a shoe rack near the door, and clean your dog's paws with soft cleaning wipes or a gentle brush before it enters your home. Put mattresses and pillows in dust mite-proof covers. These barriers help prevent infestation with allergens, which can thrive on and in your bed. Swap out curtains for shades. Fabric, particularly the high-texture sorts, invites dust. If you can't part with your curtains, vacuum them every week and wash them once a season. Be window smart. Whether to open your windows depends on where you live and changing outdoor conditions. If you live in an area with air pollution from wildfires, traffic, or other sources, keeping the window closed makes sense. In other cases, opening the windows on nice days can help clear the air. Rethink your rug. Rugs trap dust, and the bigger the rug, the bigger the problem. So opt for area rugs over carpets and choose low or no-pile designs or stick with bare floors. Consider bookcases with doors that can reduce your dusting and keep clutter, also a big dust collector, out of sight. CR's Guide to Dust Control. Even if you take precautions listed earlier to keep dust out of your living space, some will still get in. When it does, your goal is to limit the spread in the air. Then when the dust settles, we have the best methods and tools for whisking it away. In your air purifiers. These devices draw in air that's in your home, trap pollutants with filters that are in the devices, then send the clean air back out. HEPA filters, the most common type found in air purifiers, are designed to capture at least 99.97% of particles 0.3 micrometer in diameter, the size of many dust particles. Where to use them? Air purifiers should be placed in the rooms where you spend most time, and close to things such as a fireplace, a wood stove, or your pet's favorite resting place that may create a lot of dust. They work best when they're run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That constant cleaning reduces particulate matter, aka dust, before it reaches your floor. But because the devices are on all the time, you want ones that do a great job of cleaning the air without making a racket. Place them at least 6 inches from any wall or large piece of furniture to allow for a good airflow. Keep them clean. For devices to work well, air purifier filters need to be regularly cleaned or changed. Many devices have a light indicating when the filters need to be replaced. For those without the light, check the filter every 3 months and change or clean it when it looks dirty. They also often come with a pre-filter, such as a mesh fabric on the outside of the device. So make sure you follow instructions for keeping that clean, too. New filters, especially HEPA filters, can be pricey, with some costing up to $200. Factor in those costs when choosing an air purifier. To help in that effort, CR's rating factors and information about the cost of filter replacements. Pro tip, keep your air fryer on auto mode. That limits noise, reduces energy consumption, and ensures that air quality in your room is optimal. HVAC air filters. If your house has an HVAC heating and cooling system, it has a filter that prevents equipment from damage and improves air quality. Basic models are made from strands of fiberglass or metal mesh and capture large particles. Higher-end filters are pleated and can capture particles such as tiny as bacteria. Their performance is reflected in something called their MERV rating, which ranges from 1 to 16. Filters with a MERV rating of 8 can capture pollen, mold spores, and many types of household dust. At MERV 13, the highest rating you'll find for most of the popular residential HVAC filter sizes, you can count on the filter to trap bacteria, smoke, and other microscopic particles. They can cost $40 or more. Where to use them? These filters belong in your HVA system's return air duct. Because these systems work in a loop, drawing in air through your home's return vents and then releasing warm or cool air through supply ducts and vents, dust and dirt are bound to get caught up in the continuous circuit. How do you maintain them? Most HVA filters need to be replaced once per season, roughly every 3 months, says Misha Kolontai, who manages CR air filter testing, but some can last as long as 12 months depending on the model. Replace them more often if you have a pet, live in an area of the country that's prone to wildfire smoke, or suffer from allergies or asthma. Replacing the out filter is a simple job that typically involves slipping out the old one and sliding in the new one. If you are unsure how to do this, ask the person who services your home heating or cooling system to show you during their next visit. We find that thicker filters have two big advantages, Kolontai says. They filter particles out of the air better and require replacement less often. But none of our HVAC system can accommodate a thicker filter. The most common size is 1 inch thick, though you can retrofit the ductwork of some systems to accept ones that's thicker. Dehumidifiers. Keep your home at a relatively low humidity level, below 50%. Can limit the spread of dust, mites, and the allergens they produce. A dehumidifier can help you do that. Where to use it? Running a dehumidifier in the basement may help reduce humidity in the whole house, says M. Bilal Khalid, M.D., a Delaware allergist and clinical immunologist. He says keeping indoor humidity levels below 50% may be especially helpful to people who are allergic to dust mites. These pests thrive on moisture and human skin cells. They make their homes in bedding, upholstery, carpets, and other soft surfaces. When all three are present, they grow exponentially, Collins says. Choose a dehumidifier that's big enough to handle the space you want to keep dry, opting for a larger one if the area is typically damp. Wherever you place it, make sure your dehumidifier is at least a foot from the walls and furniture so that air can freely flow in and out. Note that some dehumidifiers vent on the top, others on the side. How to maintain it? Check the dehumidifier's indicator lights to know when it's time to clean the filter, and if the device isn't hooked up to a hose and drain, empty the water tank. Pro tip, check our ratings for dehumidifier with an accurate humistat. It's a control that turns the device off when it reaches a set humidity, and back on when the humidity levels go back up again. All right, best air purifiers. Models suitable for big rooms could also work in smaller ones at a lower speed, which can be quieter. Small room, Germ Garden CDAP Fit 4500 for $90, scored an 85. For a medium room, it's the Samsung Blue Sky AX26BG for $328. It scored a 79. For a large room, the Blue Air Pure 211i Max for $349, scored an 82. For an extra large room, the Conway Armega Pro X 3522F, 763, scored an 85. Best air filters. Here are two top-rated HVAC air filters. 1-inch Filtrete MBR 1900 filter for $23. 4-inch Appleair Healthy Home 213 MERV 13 for $57. The first one scored 68, the second one 75. The best humidifiers. These top humidifiers have different size capacities. Small capacity Midea MAD20 dehumidifier for $220, scored an 87. Medium capacity is the MAD35S dehumidifier, $245, scored a 95. And a large capacity is the Honeywell TP70-0, $360, 80 screens, scored an 83. On surfaces, cleaning cloths. For routine dusting, a cotton rag moistened with water works well as a cheap and environmentally friendly option, says Stephen Sharp, Vice President of Fiber Innovation and Strategic Facilities at Gaston College Textile Center in Belmont, North Carolina. Dust adheres more easily to a slightly damp cloth than to a dry one, and the water makes the cloth more pliable, the better to get any nicks and grooves, like on a wood bench, says Rachel O'Brien, Ph.D., Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Michigan. When you're done, rinse out the debris and throw the cloth into the wash to use again. To kick it up a notch, consider a damp microfiber cloth. It provides lots of surface area for dust to stick to. Use a dry, not a damp microfiber cloth on electronics and screens. It will scratch less and reduce smudging. Wash is directed to reuse. Polypropylene sheets like Swiffer wipes have randomly arranged fibers that can provide an electrostatic charge, which allows them to hang onto dust a bit better. However, they're relatively pliable and are not reusable. How often do you use them? Dust easy to reach spots every week or two, and more often if you have small kids or pets. For areas that require a stepladder like the top of bookshelves, dust once a month. Pro tip, fold your cloth in half and then in half again so that you have 8 clean surfaces on each cloth to work through. Dusters. Irregularly shaped objects require a duster. Should have a fluffy head so that you can attack multiple surfaces at once, such as a plant or trophy. It's catch particles that get knocked off as you dust, think a chandelier. It should have a flexible handle so that you can skim along curved objects like vases or lamps and squeeze into tight spots, say between picture frames. Dusters with microfiber or polypropylene work best. Those made with feathers are delicate and hard to clean, while lambswool dusters don't hang onto dust as well. How often do you use them? Break out the duster as frequently as you've been using a dust cloth, weekly or biweekly for options within your reach, like your window AC vents, monthly for less accessible surfaces like ceiling fans. Pro tip, in each room, dust from top to bottom and work from edge to edge. That way you get over 3 chances to catch every last dust mite, as a stray particle that fell off your ceiling fan can land on the counter. And if you miss it when you wipe the counter, it falls to the floor where you vacuum and mop last, says Melissa Homer, consultant for the residential cleaning service EcoMades, headquartered in Holmdel, New Jersey. A Swisher microfiber duster kit starts at $8 for 5 sheets a handle. To save money, avoid waste. Get better results. Start with the cleanest room and end with the bathroom, says Maria Strimer, a senior manager of Global Scientific Communications at Procter & Gamble, maker of Swifter products. That keeps you from introducing new debris into a cleaner room. Do you really need furniture spray? 45% of Americans use a dust spray or furniture polish, according to a 2024 nationally representative CR survey of 2,042 adults. On hard surfaces, a spray or polish can help pick up dust while leaving a shine behind. But a slightly damp cloth, followed on wood with a swipe with a dry one, does a good job. Plus ingredients in some products may pose health or environmental concerns, so you may prefer to play it safe and avoid them, says Christopher M. Reddy, Ph.D., who studies sustainable products at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. For a product with fewer concerning ingredients, consider one certified by Made Safe, an organization that screens household products. Or try this do-it-yourself recipe. Mix 1/2 cup of lemon juice and a few drops of olive oil in a bottle. Spray, then wipe with a cloth. 6 places where dust can hide. The most frustrating thing about dust is how pervasive it actually is, says home care expert Melissa Homer, whose career includes 18 years of developing cleaning procedures for residential sleeping rooms made pro. Here's where to scout for dust. In high places. Think the tops of doors, windows, bookshelves, and picture frames. To clean, use a microfiber towel, damp them with water, or an all-purpose cleaner. If you can't reach, use a duster on an extension pole. Under furniture, that includes below the bed or couch, behind the toilet, and in the backs of closets. To clean, use a wet-dry microfiber mop or an extendable duster. On blinds and air vents, dust loves to hide in the slats. To clean, close the slats twice with a damp cloth, then reverse the slats and wipe again. If they're still dirty, wash gently in a bathtub of warm, soapy water. On drapes, also on upholstered furniture, use your vacuum hose, adjusting the suction to avoid damaging delicate ornaments like lampshades. Under range hoods, steam and vaporized oil makes dust stick there, and to kitchen cabinets and fans. To clean, spray with a degreaser, approved for the surface, then wipe for fans, spray an extendable duster with all-purpose cleaner, blend into a C-shape, and draw over each blade. Behind appliances, dust that scatters behind a refrigerator, washer, or dryer can interfere with its operation. To clean, if you can't pull out the appliance, sneak a vacuum home or flexible duster on a pole, if needed, behind and under it. Brooms and mops. Vacuums work better because sweepy can stir dumb bass into the air. Still, brooms can be a quick way to pick up larger bits of food or other debris that attract dust, or over time break into smaller specks. Soft bristles with flagged tips that look like split ends catch smaller particles best, says Steve Zelbanski, senior manager at Industry and Safety Supply Company Granger. An angled shape, where one side is longer than others, lets you get into quarters and devices, crevices and beneath appliances. If pet hair is an issue, Tanya Roark, co-owner of All Pro Cleaning in Missouri's Lake of the Ozarks area, suggests the Broom Bee. That's Broom Bee, as BROOMBI.com. She uses that when she doesn't want to break out the vacuum. Instead of bristles, it has a Worsen electrostatic silicone edge that picks up hair and other debris without getting tangled. Periodically follow up with a mop and sudsy water. Roark prefers spin mops with 2 tank buckets, one for clean water and the other for dirty. 2 options, Tovar Split Bucket Basic and O-Cedar Easy Ring Rinse Clean. Throw the mop heads into the washing machine to reuse. How often do you use them? Sweep as needed. Mop once a week or more, often if you have a small child or pets. Pro tip, sweep your floor section by section, making a small pile for each area. By sweeping shorter distances, you use fewer particles along the way. After sweeping, use a wet paper towel to wipe down the bristles and periodically clean the broom with a dish and soap and water. Vacuums. Your key tool against dust is a vacuum. So you want one that gets top scores in CR tests for cleaning carpets and bare floors, hose suction, especially emissions. Vacuums that excel in the ladder test have light, tight seals and excellent filters to keep vacuumed up debris from spewing back into the air. If the entire system is not sealed, it doesn't matter how good the filters are, says Susan Booth, who oversees CR's vacuum testing. Bagged and vacuum vacuums have gotten better at curbing emissions, but a bag model eliminates the messy job of emptying the bin of a bagless model. How often do you use them? At least once a week, especially if you have an active family with people and pets coming and going, live on a dusty road, or have allergies. Where to use them? Take advantage of attachments. Use the crevice tool to get at hard-to-reach places like high corners and behind furniture. Use brushes and upholstery, lampshades, window blinds, and curtains. Many vacuums come with suction control, which makes it easier to clean curtains or drapes. Most do this with a slider that diverts some of the hose's suctioning power, but high-end vacuums may have a dial for more accurate adjustments. Pro tip, when buying a vacuum, pay special attention to the bags and filters. If you are very concerned about or sensitive to dust, get them all over the heap of HEPA bags or a HEPA filter, Booth says. HEPA filters remove at least 99.97% of dust, pollen, and other airborne particles. Regular vacuum bags and HEPA bags are typically interchangeable, but check your owner's manual to make sure. If you don't find dust particularly bothersome, you could do without the HEPA filters. The upright, their favorite best vacuums are the Kenmore Elite Pet Friendly for $350, and the canister, the Mile Complete for $1,300, and the cordless stick, the Mile Triflex XX1 for $600. How about a couple of jokes? Please stop asking me to send a calendar invite. I don't know what that means. The calendar invite was me asking you to do the thing. You manage your own little calendar. Early one morning, while on my way to work, I stopped at a coffee shop and gave the barista my order, medium skim decaf latte. The barista read back my order, one medium, why bother? Good resume helps one land jobs. A bad resume lands here. Working at XX Airline, I gained experience managing the cabin crew in a pressurized environment. My hobbies include regular attendance at my local gym and swimming pool. Previously at Starbucks Coffee Company, the position I occupied allowed me to serve customers and exceed their expectation for providing them with the right product. Growing up with last name Odor has never been easy, nor has it ever been. On my great-uncle's first day at seminary school, the professor called on him and asked him his name. Ivan Odor, he said. Son, the professor, I just want to know your name. I don't know your personal problems. Before GPS by Bob at our courier company was lost on a rural road, so he asked the local for direction. Go as far as you can see twice, and there's your turn, said the local. Confused, but with no better option, my boss fixed his eyes on a spot as far as he could see. He drove to that spot and made a mental note of the next farthest spot as he see. Upon arriving at the second spot, dead on, was the little unmarked turn he was looking for. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks so much for listening.